You are now listening to MacroDose.
Hello and welcome to MacroDose, a podcast hosted by me, James Meadway, that brings you your weekly fix of everything economics in a quick 15-minute roundup. Each Wednesday morning, we bring you the key stories making the news and the analysis you need to make sense of them. On today's episode, we'll take a look at, first, some groundbreaking new research that shows the world will lose one-fifth of its income to climate change over the next 25 years. Second, we return to the uninsurable world, looking at the skyrocketing price of insurance here in the UK. And finally, some allegedly good news as the London Stock Exchange hits a record high. Before we begin today, I just wanted to take this opportunity to flag another exciting live event run by our friends at the podcast Politics Theory Other. PTO is the podcast that helped MacroDose get up and running when we first started back in 2022, and host Alex Doherty has provided some of the best analysis around Israel's war in Palestine, as well as numerous other vital topics. On May the 16th, Alex will be joined by authors Gargi Bhattacharya and Richard Seymour at the offices of Planet B Productions in North London. Together, Gargi and Richard will address the reasons behind surging support for the contemporary far right, how the left should respond, and whether what we are seeing is the emergence of a 21st century iteration of fascism. This promises to be a fascinating and vital discussion. We will leave a link to tickets in the show notes. And if you don't follow PTO already, you're missing out. Search Politics Theory Other wherever you get your podcasts. Time for our first story this week, groundbreaking new research into the economic impacts of climate breakdown. Last week, a new piece of research was published in the weekly international journal Nature that provided the most comprehensive analysis of the economic fallout of climate change that really anyone has attempted to date. The widely reported results are, as you might expect, less than amazing. The headline is that, relative to the scenario without climate change, the world will lose around one-fifth of its income over the next 25 years. That's 19% of global income over that quarter century. Or to put it in money terms, it comes to around $38 trillion every year from 2050 onwards. What the researchers at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact did was take 40 years' worth of data on how both temperature and precipitation have impacted economic activity everywhere on the planet and find a sensible way to combine this into an aggregate figure. That then allows the model to estimate not only the worldwide impact of climate change, but also the specific likely economic impacts on regions and countries. The variations here become very big. The UK loses out by 7%, Germany by 11%, and the US by 11%. But the worst affected countries are, predictably, those already in warm regions. Brazil loses 21%, Botswana 25%, Pakistan by 26%, for instance. And equally predictably, the research shows that the distribution of losses has no relationship to the distribution of contribution to climate change. In other words, really big greenhouse gas emitters tend to get hit less severely than poorer countries that made a much smaller historic contribution. Now, there are a few things to note about the research. First, although the study is far more detailed than anything that has been attempted before, breaking new ground in both the depth and the scope of what it considers, it still isn't truly comprehensive. It looks only at temperatures and precipitation, and therefore doesn't include, for example, the extensive damage from sea levels rising, or the increased spread of diseases, or the terrible effects on human health of excess heat over time. The second thing to note here is that this study is backward-looking. It takes historic data and tries to project it into the future, in combination with a simulation of climate change. The obvious problem with this is that it will miss any new climate impacts that don't have a recent precedent. We covered a good example of this on the show 2 weeks ago, with jellyfish swarms increasingly hitting nuclear power plant intakes. That kind of essentially unexpected, novel development won't be covered in this kind of modelling. And that's a problem. Related to this, there is no provision in the model for any kind of climate tipping point, the point at which a complex system rapidly moves into a different state, where we find ourselves in the, quote, new normal. Take thawing tundra, for instance, which could release tons of methane into the atmosphere, rapidly increasing total emissions. or the sudden loss of critical parts of the ecosystem, which could provoke widespread crop failures. These kinds of rapid changes in our environment are increasingly plausible and are difficult to build into models reliant on looking at past relationships between different variables. So put all of this together, and what you're looking at from these results is a low estimate for the likely future costs of climate change. Once you start to stack up everything that isn't in the model, it's clear that the true impacts are likely to be even worse. But something else to be clear on is that when the headline result says income is down 19% globally, it doesn't mean we'll all be 19% worse off. This would be a catastrophic decline in living standards, equivalent in peacetime to that suffered by Hungary, for example, under so-called shock therapy in the early 1990s. But what it is telling you is that relative to the model forecast without climate change, we will, on average, be around one-fifth worse off. It's like the Brexit loss forecasts you sometimes see. Everyone in Britain is not actually 5% or whatever worse off from Brexit, but the models typically tell us we have collectively got 5% less than we would have had without Brexit. So it's not catastrophic as such. It's more that everything is slowly getting more and more difficult. See here our episode from 2 weeks ago on enshittification. We can reasonably expect everything in the future to be worse than we might have anticipated without climate change. For poorer countries, the implication is that promises of growth in the future are likely to be misplaced. Only redistribution, reversing centuries of colonial flows upwards and outwards, will produce a fairer world. And for those of us in richer countries, or most of us, it means the promise of growth is unlikely to deliver. We will need redistribution from the top end of the income and wealth scale to everyone else, whether directly in the form of money payments, perhaps in universal basic income, or indirectly through improved public services. Either way, the results here should be taken as a solid, evidence-based support for the kind of economic future Makrodose has always argued we are heading into, and the kinds of policies we might need to deal with it. Without wealth redistribution, both internationally and within countries, the predictable economic impacts of climate change will only land on those least able to withstand them. On to our second story this week, the uninsurable world. Back in February, we posted an episode of Makrodose entitled Why Your Easter Egg is Smaller This Year, which covered, amongst other things, a piece in the Financial Times laying out how the world is becoming uninsurable as climate change meets capitalism. Last week, the FT's insurance correspondent Ian Smith ran another piece along similar lines, zeroing in specifically on the problem of home insurance here in the UK. And I quote, "A succession of severe storms last year left UK home insurers on the hook for £573 million in weather damage, the highest since the data began to be tracked 7 years ago. High winds and flying debris from a series of storms, including Babet, Kieran and Debbie in October and November, left a trail of damage, with subsequent widespread flooding contributing £268 million to the bill," unquote. The insurer's response to higher payouts over the last few years has been to start pushing up the charges they make to homeowners. The average price of home insurance rose nearly 20% in the last year to £364. As we've covered on Makrodose before, it's a similar story appearing across much of the developed world. More and more extreme weather events are leading to more insurance claims, which in turn leads the insurers to put up prices. As Christian Mumenthaler, chief executive of Swiss Re, one of the world's biggest reinsurers, told delegates to the annual Davos gathering of the world's elite back in January this year, and I'm quoting the FT again, "This is the first time we actually bring a climate change bill back to the consumer," end quote. Or in some cases, stop offering insurance at all, since, for the insurer, the risks are now too high to be profitable, as is now happening on a large scale in parts of Florida and California, and even in bits of the UK. When private, profit-seeking insurance companies are refusing to offer insurance, householders have to turn to the insurer of last resort services offered by the government. In the UK, the Flood Re reinsurance scheme is now underwriting 260,000 home insurance policies, up from 150,000 in 2018. But this extreme weather impact isn't just affecting home insurance. Car insurance prices have gone through the roof, Again, not only in the UK, where average insurance premiums have risen by 34% in the last year, but across Europe and North America. The biggest single contributor to the US's recent rise in inflation, when official figures came out last week, was the rising cost of insurance, including motor insurance. Now, Britain has had some of the highest motor insurance price increases in Europe, and some of this looks like it is profiteering. The insurance industry likes to blame rising costs for rising prices. But whilst prices in the UK have gone up 34%, payouts by insurers have only risen 18%. In the rest of Europe, price rises have been much more limited, just 6% in Spain and 2% in France, with different, tighter market regulations likely to play their part here. Nonetheless, the rise in costs to insurers has been real and has taken place everywhere. There's a kind of reinforcement effect from inflation here. Because car prices have shot up so much, the costs of insurance claims have also risen, and the increasing sophistication of cars with semiconductors and sensors all over them is making repairs more complex and so more costly. But extreme weather also plays its part. Damage and accidents become more likely as the weather gets worse. Put all this together, and what you get is another squeeze on living standards through the familiar combination of climate change and profit maximising. What economist Isabella Weber outlined here at Macrodose as supply chain disruption and seller's inflation. Here in the UK, there have been calls in Parliament for an investigation by the Financial Conduct Authority into those insurance price rises, although the FCA somewhat typically says there is nothing to see here. All of this is a problem worth noting, but I think the larger, lurking danger behind this is the way the insurance industry ties into the wider financial system. To operate profitably, insurance companies depend on having many different households or cars or whatever that they insure. As long as the chances of them having various accidents and misfortunes don't match each other, so not everyone claims all at once, the company can take in fees, make some payouts, and turn a profit. But here lies the problem. If everyone tries to claim all at once, the company goes bankrupt. This is what happened to one of the largest insurers on the planet back in 2008, the American International Group, AIG, which had been offering insurance against the complex financial packages of US household mortgages that major banks and financial institutions had been making and trading. When these packages, like the notorious collateralized debt obligations, started to fail en masse, AIG ended up with a $99 billion bill in total. It was only saved from bankruptcy and failure with a massive loan from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, a bailout in other words. The problem then was that all these claims for insurance payouts arrived at the same time, in the middle of a financial crisis. This is what's called a systemic risk. What's critical about climate change, from the financial system's point of view, is that it makes it more and more likely that many disasters will arrive all at the same time. You get more, and often bigger, extreme weather events, so at any point in time you, as the insurer, are likely to face more claims. It's a guarantee of rising systemic risk in the financial system, with insurance companies perhaps the worst affected. We more or less know what the likely outcome is here, and it's the same as it was in 2008, a bailout from government. This is actually already happening, with governments like Britain's effectively working to prop up the household insurance market by offering insurance to those households who couldn't get it otherwise. This leaves the private insurance companies free to offer insurance only to the profitable, that is, less risky, prospects. And that, in turn, will mean more government borrowing, more government debt, and more demands for austerity. The first step in a solution is likely to be simply squeezing out the private, profit-making element of insurance. Let the lower-risk households subsidise higher risk, strip out the additional costs of the profit, and in principle, everyone can benefit. Further down the line, we need more comprehensive forms of insurance against all kinds of risks, like paying everyone a basic income, as we covered recently in the new campaign for a farmer's basic income. And further still, we need redesigns of our towns and cities and the systems we rely on to make them far more robust to extreme weather shocks. The uninsurable world isn't going away, and it's time we begin thinking in universal terms about our collective vulnerabilities. If we continue to bet on some being fine and others not, we're leaving ourselves open to yet more instability, an extreme weather that sends repeated shockwaves through our financial systems. Our third and final story this week is a brief note on a piece of allegedly good news, the London Stock Exchange hitting a record high. Now, you might want to hold off on the champagne just yet, because as you may have noticed, it's not as if much else in the currently recession-hit UK economy is going especially well, although forecasts for the rest of the year show some minor improvements. But on the back of UK inflation coming down faster than other big developed economies, there's an expectation amongst traders that the Bank of England will cut interest rates, cutting borrowing costs and stoking up the economy, which, in turn, implies more revenues for companies being traded on the stock exchange. It's worth breaking that big picture down a bit. Share prices, like anything else in a market, are determined by trading, by people and institutions, in this case buying and selling shares. They'll tend to go up when people want to buy a share in the expectation that the company it is attached to is going to do well in the future. So it's interesting to note that the top riser in value on the London Stock Exchange so far this year is the engineering firm Rolls-Royce. Critically, Rolls-Royce make aero engines for the military, everything from helicopter engines to the engines used in drones. The more military expenditure in the future, the better military manufacturers like Rolls-Royce can be expected to do. That implies more sales in the future, more profits, and so more buyers for Rolls-Royce shares, driving their price up. The rise in Rolls-Royce's share price since October the 7th, when Hamas attacked Israel and Israel responded with the ongoing appalling assault on Gaza, has far outpaced the so-called Magnificent Seven US tech stocks like Apple, Meta, and Microsoft. Rising geopolitical tensions and talk of much higher arms spending in the future is brilliant for arms manufacturers. If you think the world is going down the drain, buy shares in arms companies. Not to put too fine a point in it, but this record high for the London Stock Exchange last week is another example of how divorced the financial system can be from everyday economic realities. What's good for a trader and good for an arms manufacturer can be pretty appalling for everyone else. And that brings me onto one final note to end today's show with. Along with the rest of the Macrodose team, I wanted to express my solidarity with those under assault in Gaza and the occupation across Palestine. And with that, we'd also like to show our support for the protests now spreading across university campuses in the United States. To all of our fellow teachers and students who have joined the encampments, we are with you. End the occupation. Ceasefire now. Thank you for listening to today's show. Macrodose is a Planet B production. If you enjoyed the show and you'd recommend it to friends, please consider leaving us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. You can find all our episodes, including our bonus interview content, on our Patreon at patreon.com/macrodose.